the welcoming host, as it were, to the University of Strathclyde to welcome so many of you here to this public lecture this evening. It gives me great pleasure to welcome you to this, the culmination of a series of events organised this year around the Donaldson report and its recommendations by the Teacher Education and Teachers Work Research Group, which is a joint research group, Universities of Strathclyde and Glasgow. But it's such a pleasure to welcome so many colleagues here from all over the country, from different universities, from local authorities, from schools, from GTC Scotland, from Education Scotland, and other relevant organisations. It's a great pleasure to welcome you all here to the University of Strathclyde. It doesn't surprise me that we've got such a good turnout for this evening, given the identity of our lecturer this evening, who I have the pleasure now of introducing to you. It is rather trite, I think, to use the phrase that a certain individual needs no introduction. But that's, in this case, probably true, and I should just say nothing at all. Ian Mentor, our speaker tonight, is someone who has made a huge impact on education in Scotland in the period of time that he's been with us. And he's going to reflect on the 10 years that he's been north of the border, involved so closely in developments taking place in teacher education during that period. Ian's background is a very interesting one. Having started out as a teacher himself in primary schools, he has been involved in teacher education both south and north of the border, formerly in University of North London and University of the West of England. He was involved in teacher education programmes there before moving in a very astute move north of the border in 2001 to take up his position at the then University of Paisley, shortly to become University of West of Scotland. After 2 years or so, two or 3 years there, moving on to the University of Glasgow. And straight away, we had to acknowledge that somebody rather special had arrived in our midst. And this was brought home very, very rapidly by his immediate involvement in all aspects of the education research community and the kinds of things that were going on at that time. He got very quickly involved in the Scottish Education Research Association, almost instantly became an office bearer within the executive during that period, straight after his arrival in Scotland. Very quickly was capitalising on what he himself at the time shared as a very exciting opportunity to compare what was happening north of the border with what was happening south of the border. It was my pleasure, and Ian will maybe refer to this later on this evening, but I was just coming to the end of a period, rather troubled period, as editor of the Scottish Education Review, and straight away, and Ian was actually talking about this, and he will say a bit more about it later, Ian was already publishing around the topic of comparing England and Scotland, because he's an article in 2002 which was focusing on teacher supply issues with the title Border Crossing, deeply symbolic. During that period, since his arrival, just a little over 10 years ago, Ian has been involved in so many initiatives. It would take the full hour for me to mention them, and it wouldn't be appropriate. Ian will describe those himself during his reflections. But it's fair to say that Ian's involvement in so many different initiatives is characterized by the kind of positive relationships that are very, very rarely seen, so consistently being achieved by a single individual. Ian's relationships with colleagues, in his own institution, with colleagues in other institutions, colleagues in different organizations, have all been characterized by positive, constructive, and very, very worthwhile developments. In his period as CIRA president, establishing very strong relationships with the Scottish Government, very constructive relationships with General Teaching Council and other bodies. And it's a reflection on the character of Ian Mentor that those relationships have been so consistently positive and constructive and productive. We've all benefited from Ian's time in Scotland, and we look forward to hearing his reflections on this period in his lecture tonight, when he will reflect on not only the things that he's been involved in directly, but some of the things that have been shaping the landscape during the last 10 years. So, really, I would wish not to take up any more of the time, just to say that as we do face the prospect of losing Ian from the Scottish landscape to the dreamy spires of Oxford next month, we clearly acknowledge that our loss is Oxford's gain, and we also express a desire, even at this point, that the relationships that have been so constructive will be maintained, and that the perspective that you've brought to bear and the insights that you've brought in the work that you've done while you've been in Scotland will continue, and we'll benefit from that, but in different ways in times to come. So, without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to and welcome to the floor our speaker for tonight, Professor Ian Mentor of the University of Glasgow.
Well, thanks very much, Donald. I'll pay you later. And nice suit, I would say. This is actually one of the most daunting gigs I've done since arriving in Scotland. And you may be looking forward to it somewhat more than I am, but we'll maybe reverse roles in about 45 minutes' time. Some of you may be aware that this is being broadcast on Radio EduTalk, and I'm very pleased to have been invited by David Noble and his colleagues to permit the broadcast of this talk, and hope that somebody is going to listen to it and find it interesting. I've used the fact that it's being broadcast as a very good excuse for actually not using any PowerPoint slides tonight at all. You're going to have to listen. There will be the odd picture. Donald didn't quite realise that he was showing you the guest list as he put his notes down on the visualiser. This is a visualiser, Donald. And when you put a piece of paper on there, it shows up. There. It's relatively low-tech, but it still seems to work. Anyway, I would like to thank you all very much for giving up the time to come this evening. It's very kind of you. And I do hope that a little bit of what I've got to offer is going to be of some interest. I think if I talk long enough, and with Donald's reasonably concise introduction there may not be any time for questions. We shall see. Donald and I didn't do a deal on that beforehand. We'll just see how long this actually does last. Right, teaching matters. Why does teaching matter? I probably don't need to persuade this particular audience of why teaching matters, but certainly it's a message, teaching matters, that has become clearer and clearer to me as I've worked for these past 10 or 11 years in Scotland. And the title, Teaching Matters, actually tries to point to three perspectives. It is an exhortation. Teaching does matter. It's important in society. But it's also a descriptive title for this talk. There are matters to do with teaching that I want to talk about and have been researching over the last years. But in using the word matters, I'm also seeking to draw attention to the material conditions of teachers' working lives. Inspired, as ever, by the work of another crosser of borders, Raymond Williams, I've sought to take an approach in my work based on what he coined cultural materialism. But don't worry, this is not the occasion for a heavy theoretical take. Don't get the eyes glaze over quite yet. I'm going to start with a bit of a narrative. Arriving in those very green fields beside the River Aire in June 2001, at what was then the University of Paisley, although all the locals, and some people here as well, I noticed earlier, still called it Craigie College, the contrast with the Holloway Road, otherwise known as the A1, the Great North Road in Islington, where I had worked at what was then the University of North London, could hardly have been more stark. And of course, both those universities have changed their name in the short time since I moved north. The one to the University of the West of Scotland, and the other to London Metropolitan University. Indeed, as I said last night, or the night before last, to some colleagues at Glasgow, every HE institution I've worked in has changed its name, usually after I've left. Although I think that's less likely to happen when I leave the University of Glasgow, or indeed when I eventually retire from the University of Oxford. So I had arrived, as Donald mentioned, in Scotland in 2001 with an existing interest not only in teacher education, but in the topic of teacher supply and retention, and in teachers' work. Indeed, as Donald mentioned, quite soon after I arrived, I submitted a paper to the Scottish Educational Review, which Donald then edited, and I waited, and I waited. No, I didn't. I'm teasing. It was a very speedy response, and with a few tweaks, and then later on, I worked out who the referees had been, because it is a small community, and you get to know people's foibles, shall we say. But it was published, and it was published with the title of Border Crossing, because it had struck me very hard how strong the differences in the working world that I had entered were. It was an initial exploration of why the issues of teacher supply and retention seemed to be less acute, that point up here than they were at that point down south. 2001 was a good year in which to make the move. The Scottish Parliament had been established for a couple of years, and the Macron report of 2000 had been developed into the agreement, A Teaching Profession for the 21st Century, which contrasted quite markedly with the English Green Paper from a couple of years earlier, entitled Teachers Meeting the Challenge of Change. When I moved north, the project that I had just started with my colleagues in England, Pat Marney and Ian Hextall, was an investigation of what was called threshold assessment, what others might more crudely call performance pay for teachers. I was curious why there was not the same rush to introduce performance management in Scotland. So I arranged some interviews with key stakeholders and asked them what they thought. And that led to another paper, one that I'm rather proud of, called Ne'er the Twain, because it was starting to suggest that there were some deep cultural significant differences between the framing of teaching in Scotland and in England. That paper was published in the Journal of Education Policy, and I suppose really was the emergence for me of the commitment to what David Rafe at Edinburgh had coined as home international study of education, looking within the UK at similarities and differences. But as my interest was growing in these apparently very significant differences between teaching and teacher education and teachers' work in Scotland and England. So came some more opportunities. The University of Paisley was wanting to enhance its research profile, so Ian Smith and I drew up an internal application which led to the project Convergence or Divergence. We were very fortunate in appointing the greatly missed Estelle Brizard as our researcher on that project. She was then undertaking a doctoral study at Stirling, comparing teacher education in France, England, and Scotland. It was this project at Paisley which led to the book published by Dunedin Press that actually provided firm evidence of what I was personally experiencing in my own work, a hugely different cultural setting for the practices of initial teacher education in the two countries. And this has been a continuing source of fascination for me ever since, and indeed gave rise to that belief that the Home International Studies had a particular and very important contribution to make to the study of educational policy and practice, certainly within the UK, but also, as we've found when we've talked at European and American conferences, in a wider context. While I was at Paisley, we also succeeded in securing contracts for two literature reviews that were being commissioned at that time by the GTC, the General Teaching Council in Scotland. One was on partnership in initial teacher education, the other on widening access to teacher education. And that latter one, the one on widening access, provided the opportunity to work with other colleagues at Paisley, but also to develop and initiate, really, a collaboration with Jerry Smith, which she's gone, there she is, of Strathclyde, whom I'd got to know previously through involvement in our work in a group called REMIT, which was seeking to recruit more black and minority ethnic students into teaching in Scotland. When I'd been at North London, we'd had the highest proportion of black and minority ethnic student teachers anywhere in the UK, and were very proud of the contribution that was making to increasing diversity in the workforce. At AIR, we were lucky, were we not, if we recruited one or two black and minority ethnic students each year. And this pattern was largely reflected elsewhere in Scotland, really with only Strathclyde, I would suggest, being relatively successful in that area. There are indeed a number of ways in which the Scottish teaching workforce as currently constituted failed and fails to reflect the diversity of the population at large. And this is an issue which seems only to generate wider concern somewhat spasmodically. Where work was more successful in relation to diversity was in the rights project, Refugees into Teaching in Scotland, led from Strathclyde by Jerry, with her at the helm and me leading on the research front. This project, Rights, is no longer funded, but for about 4 years, I think, 4 or 5 years, we succeeded through a partnership between the West of Scotland universities, the GTC, local authorities, Scottish Government, or SEED initially, and others. We were able to support a very significant number of teachers who had come to Scotland as refugees in meeting the challenges they faced in joining the teaching profession here. A project which has been much praised from other parts of the UK, and indeed to some extent modelled, the practices have been modelled south of the border. Going back again though, back to Paisley, about a year or so after arriving at Paisley, Chris Holligan, who's still there, and I, put in a tender to the Scottish Executive, as it then was, SEED, the Scottish Executive Education Department, to evaluate, to carry out the national evaluation of the SQH, the Scottish Qualification for Headship. I was very pleased we were successful in bidding for that project, and over a period of a few months, we carried out the first national study of that innovative scheme. That was the project that led to my first and possibly last flight in an 8-seater Otter plane, landing in a blizzard on one of the more remote Orkney Islands. Nice work if you can get it. And where I was the only resident in the one hotel on the island, arriving the night before visiting a school, and the check-in conversation went something like this. "You're visiting the school then?" "Yes, I am, tomorrow." "So you'll be an inspector then?" "Well, not exactly, no," and I explained what I did, but it did make me realise that a principal off-season element of business for the more remote hotels of Scotland is indeed HMIE, as I expect Graham would testify. But I digress. That project on the SQH, I think, played a major part in subsequently securing a contract with the National College for School Leadership in England, which we saw as a bit of a coup leading an NCSL project from the University of Paisley in Scotland. Probably one of the first such contracts to be awarded outside of England, to undertake an evaluation of the head teacher induction program, where Chris Holligan and I again collaborated and brought in one of my former UNL colleagues, Merrin Hutchings. And the team also included a researcher, a former primary head teacher in England called Maggie Walker, who I'm very pleased to say is here tonight. You brought her sister. We have another relationship as well. All of these projects on head teachers did bring home to me the very challenging and complex nature of school management and leadership, especially at times of significant change. We then, from headship, turned to the topic of supply teaching in Scotland, and I again managed to involve my colleague in North London, Merrin Hutchings, in that work. That project was commissioned by SEED because there was growing concern about the management of supply cover in Scottish education and about the experience of supply teachers, a theme that seems to have returned to the headlines in recent times. And just to start to foreshadow one of the conclusions that I'm gradually working towards, it has to be noted that the recommendations that emerged from that research in 2005-06 did not really seem to be taken up at the time. And I do wonder whether we would have the same problems again now if they had been considered more carefully at that time. Later, I was part of a team led by Merrin Hutchings in England that carried out a broadly similar project there. And looking at supply teaching in England, again, the contrasts were very stark. A much more diverse set of arrangements for supply teachers in England, involving many private providers, many private companies as providers, as well as considerable recruitment of teachers from overseas, not features that really characterise the Scottish scene. As Donald mentioned, during my time at Paisley, I also became active in the Scottish Educational Research Association, and before long had joined the executive committee and later was honoured to hold the presidency of CERA for 2 years. My role in CERA, the Scottish Educational Research Association, also led to my involvement in BERA, the British Educational Research Association, ERA, the European Educational Research Association, and WERA, the World Educational Research Association. Yes, such is my longevity that I can claim to have worked in 4 eras within 10 years. And if we rearrange the SERA to AERS, it was in 2004 that the Applied Educational Research Scheme was established, which did lead to greatly increased networking within Scottish educational research. And I remember, some of you may remember this, I think Ian will, that I applied for the part-time post of AERS coordinator. I think probably looking back, it was quite fortunate that I wasn't offered it. It was a quite serious challenge, that post. But I do remember that the late Donald McIntyre was on the interview panel. Later that same year, I came across Donald McIntyre again, sitting in a vice-chancellor's office at the University of Glasgow, because he was there sitting on the interview panel for the post of Professor of Teacher Education. And I mention him because, well, he's very sadly missed, but he had a very significant influence, which continues to this day, on teacher education at Oxford, an inheritance that I'm going to be really interested to get to grips with and explore when I move there. Soon after my move to Glasgow in 2004, I was involved in some very interesting discussions between staff at the University of Strathclyde and the University of Glasgow, from the two faculties of education. Donald was also involved in those discussions. We had very grand and ambitious motives, did we not, Donald? They haven't yet entirely come to fruition, but I'll keep watching this space with great interest. And I know Donald and our head of school, our two heads of school now, Strathclyde and Bob Davis at Glasgow, are good colleagues, and they keep talking to each other, so we'll see whether we get more ambitious in the future. But what did emerge out of those discussions at that time was the TETWA research group. A modest idea, but one that seems to have been working. A joint research group looking at teacher education and teachers' work. It continues to thrive. We have our own journal, two issues now available online, and an annual conference, which last year focused on Graham Donaldson's report, and is currently planning this year's conference, which will take place at the University of Glasgow in June the 8th. I was also very honoured during that period to take on editing a special issue of Scottish Educational Review, which was published in memory of Stanley Nisbet, who, of course, held the chair of education at Glasgow, and whose book, Purpose in the Curriculum, I'd actually read when undertaking my own BEd training, education, in Bristol in the early 1970s. So that was an interesting little loop to close. I never met Stanley, although many people in this community did work with him and benefited from him. I've met his brother, John, several times. Another book that I purchased and read with interest when I was doing my BEd in the early 1970s was Soviet Education by the late Nigel Grant. It's funny what goes around comes around, because I'm told that the wine stains on the table in my office at the University of Glasgow are something to do with Nigel Grant. In that special issue for Scottish Educational Review, about half the papers were from Scotland, but there were others from England, from Northern Ireland, and from Australia. In 2005, soon after moving to Glasgow, we undertook what was called the Teacher Working Time Research with my colleagues at Glasgow, Marjorie McMahon, Christine Ford, Fiona Patrick, Alistair McPhee, John Hall, and Alison Devlin. That was a fascinating project, not only for the actual research, which included such interesting questions as what do teachers see as essential and non-essential elements in their work, and how many hours do they actually work each week? Remember, McCrone had said the working week was to be 35 hours. We couldn't find many teachers who could do their job within 35 hours. The average turned out for unpromoted teachers to be 42.5 or something like that. But it was also interesting for the politics of the research. It was commissioned by SEED on behalf of the Scottish Negotiating Committee for Teachers, SNCT, to honour a commitment that had been made in the McCrone Agreement, the TP21 Agreement. And at each advisory group meeting for this research, it was fascinating to see the way in which SEED, the civil servants from government, the employers and the unions sought subtly to influence the progress of the research and its reporting. Real insight into relations between different stakeholders in Scottish education and about research and policy and practice. Then, also in 2005, on taking on the role of deputy dean with responsibility for research development at the Faculty of Education in Glasgow, came the opportunity to appoint a research fellow, and that was when Moira Hume, there she is, arrived on the scene. And since that time, she's been a real tower of strength in developing projects, implementing them, and in writing them up. And I'll be referring to some of the work we've done together since then in a few minutes. Indeed, I'll mention other Scottish projects in due course, but among the successes achieved with Moira that were more widespread was the establishment of the Teacher Education Group, TEG, a Four Nations collaboration of researchers which drew up an annotated bibliographic resource of UK teacher education research which had been published between 2000 and 2008. The analysis of these 446 items, and I think Moira analysed about half of them and the colleague in England, Ian Extor, did the other half, showed that although a considerable amount of research was being produced on and about teacher education in the UK, relatively little of it was large scale and or cumulative and or well theorised. We also led from Glasgow a project called Learning to Teach. Learning to Teach in Post-Evolution UK, I think, was the full title, which was supported by the Teaching and Learning Research Programme, the ESRC, the Economic and Social Research Council's backed major educational research programme. That Learning to Teach project brought together teacher education researchers, practitioners and policymakers from across the four nations and enabled us to carry out something of an analysis across all four nations. Putting it a little over simply, but I hope not simplistically, was this work that did increasingly lead me to see the English approach to initial teacher training as being the odd one out. While standards and or competences were being introduced across all parts of the UK, the analysis we undertook suggested that these competences or standards were much more technicist and restricted in England than they were in Scotland, Northern Ireland, or even in Wales, which had been more closely aligned with England. The role of Deputy Dean at Glasgow, with responsibility for research, gave me a fantastic opportunity to get to know research work across our faculty there. And I do have to say that one of my proudest achievements, apart from standing in front of you tonight, of course, was the submission that we made to the 2008 research assessment exercise, which trebled the volume of the return from the previous one and doubled the income that resulted. Indeed, I'm afraid that such is the seductive power of league tables, when you're successful in them, that I find myself proud that in one of the tables that emerged, published by the higher after that RAE, in terms of research power in education, which is a combination of volume and quality, Glasgow came eighth. And who was seventh? Oxford. I also, during that period of deputy deanship, took on responsibility for the Scree Centre for a while and benefited from working with colleagues in that centre, which had been formed out of the previous Scottish Council for Research in Education. Several of the Scree staff became part of what was to be the biggest single project that we secured. It was called Research to Support Schools of Ambition, working with teachers as researchers. The team was not only an internal collaboration, we also had the involvement of Strathclyde, Donald again, and of Aberdeen, initially with Kay Livingston, and then when she moved on, with Fran Payne and some of her colleagues at Aberdeen. What was most significant about that work with the Schools of Ambition was the creation of a new kind of relationship between policy, research and practice. The national scheme identified a total of 52 secondary schools spread across the country that had developed a transformational plan that had been approved by government and led to extra funds being made available over 3 years. Our team was then commissioned to provide advice, guidance and support to teachers in those schools to carry out their own plans. This was school-based research activity that did, in at least some cases, play an important part in bringing about a strong self-evaluation culture. Whilst it was perhaps not surprising that that particular scheme was allowed to cease following the election of a new government in 2007, it is in my view a great shame that that way of working was not actually further developed in a systematic way, especially as curriculum for excellence was being introduced. But more of that in just a moment. One lasting legacy of the work on schools of ambition, however, was this book, A Guide to Practitioner Research in Education, described as an unashamedly straightforward account of educational research methods for use by teachers and lecturers who may or may not be on certificated courses. We then move on to the project that we undertook at Glasgow for Learning and Teaching Scotland, LTS, during the engagement phase in the development of Curriculum for Excellence, which provided some fascinating insights into, well, I think the right word is, the ambivalence of the teaching workforce towards these potentially re-empowering reforms. We reviewed a whole range of data from those who were piloting the new curriculum as well as those who were not, while many teachers, including some of the youngest and some of the oldest, or should I say more experienced, most experienced, saw Curriculum for Excellence as a real opportunity to undertake an enhanced professional role, there were also plenty who were suspicious, cynical, or even opposed to those developments. The suspicions and cynicism came from a feeling that so much policy had been done to them over recent years, they had little hope that this would be in any significant way different. The opposition came from those who felt it was important for government to spell out exactly what should be taught, not least because they thought or felt they would still be judged on the basis of pupil success in public exams and were anxious about that. There were, of course, a number of other teachers who were enthusiastic and saw this as an opportunity really to re-engage professionally with the curriculum and its development and implementation in their own classrooms. And I think that ambivalence, that tension is still there today, but gradually perhaps we're moving in, as I'll come to in my conclusion, to a situation where there is a real shift in teacher professionalism beginning to happen. So, following that number of major projects, such as Teacher Working Time, Schools of Ambition, Curriculum for Excellence, where are we now? How much influence has such work had on policy and practice? And where do we see such work continuing now? Well, government funding for research in education seems to have been seriously drying up recently. There's not just a drought in the southeast of England, there's a drought in Scotland as well. Donald and I presented a paper about this at the CIRA conference last November. Subsequent coverage in the TES Scotland confirmed how widespread these concerns were. It wasn't just two old windbags harping on. There was a shared concern about the absence of support for research across the country. But even that quite high-profile coverage in the TES did not seem to provoke even a defensive reaction from government. Their line was that this kind of research, not sure what they meant by that, but anyway, that's the phrase, was now the responsibility of the recently formed Education Scotland, which, from my mind, only confirmed a rather disconcerting disregard for the centrality of a strong research element in the development of high quality education systems. We were fortunate. fortunate in that context at Glasgow in winning one of the few contracts that has been on offer recently in the shape of the literature review for Graham Donaldson, which was commissioned by government to support his review of teacher education in Scotland. And that really was a significant opportunity. We were able to involve many colleagues at Glasgow in that work, several of whom are here this evening. And I hope that will be, again, a lasting resource. We are grateful to Graham's acknowledgement of the work in the report that came out, but I also hope that it will be of lasting benefit to the wider teacher education research community. And also, while in the last few period at Glasgow, I was fortunate in being invited to lead the evaluation of what we've called the Glasgow West Teacher Education Initiative, carried out with Glasgow City Council. Winnie Mallon is here tonight from Glasgow. The so-called clinical model of teacher education, which fits in very well with some of the ideas being proposed in Graham Donaldson's report. In particular, it brings an inquiry or orientation into the partnership that supports teacher education at all levels. The partnership between schools, local authorities and universities, the partnership between teachers, university staff and students. And also recently, with very limited internal University of Glasgow funding, we've been working with Ian Matheson until he took a forced period of leave, but looking forward to resuming that, Ian, soon. Ian works at the GTC, on looking at post-induction teacher employment, a project we're calling PIPE. I don't know why we have to give everything an acronym, but it seems to do that. We're looking at the employment experiences of teachers who have completed their induction year, because it ain't as smooth as it was hoped to be. And this actually came from concerns in government as well as GTC. So we've done a whole range of interviews with newly qualified teachers, which are producing a paper which we called something like Three Nights at the Call Centre, 2 Days in the School. So, you know, we've come across one person at least who is working nights in a call centre and then waiting for the phone call from the school in the morning to go in and try and complete, carry on with her teaching. Anyway, we'll be presenting papers on that in the future. Now, to move towards a conclusion, but it's a slow move. In terms of teachers' work in Scotland, we have 3 major policy planks. We have TP21 and its recent review by Jerry McCormack, looking at conditions, terms of employment, etc. We have Curriculum for Excellence and its aspiration to return, its aspiration, should be the emphasis, to return the responsibility for curriculum, at least in significant part, to teachers, together with Teaching Scotland's Future, Graham Donaldson's report. These 3 policy planks can be seen to add up to a sustained effort to reshape teacher professionalism in Scotland. Of course, there are concerns around. Some would say some Achilles heels, plural, such as exams and assessments, such as the current threat to the Chartered Teacher Scheme and the difficulties with the Teacher Induction Scheme. Not to mention continuing concerns about teacher workload, all of these things could be seen to threaten such developments. And the questions of governance, particularly the respective roles of central and local government, still create considerable tensions. But there is much to be optimistic about, even in these challenging times. There is still a much greater trust in teachers, a more consensual approach to policy development, and a broadly based commitment to education as a force for civic and democratic development, not just economic development. The greater, all of those things are greater in Scotland than what prevails south of the border. So now I face the move from, what is it, the steaming spires of Glasgow to the dreaming spires of Oxford. You may wonder, listening to me, whether I've been talking myself into retracting my resignation, Bob. Well, no. But why return to the madness of England? In a paper published in Scottish Educational Review last year, now under Ian Smith's editorship, Moira and I compared Michael Gove's white paper, The Importance of Teaching, with Graham Donaldson's Teaching Scotland's Future. The contrast between those two documents, both in terms of what they actually say, but also in terms of the processes that have through which they were generated, is very stark. Most fundamentally, the views of what teaching is are very different. In England, Ofsted is still there, and the TDA is there by another name. I think it's 1st of April, same day I moved to Oxford. It's a Sunday and it's April Fool's Day. TDA is becoming the TA. No, not the Territorial Army, although they are going to be recruiting soldiers, as we understand it, but the teaching agency. They're still there, and in my role at Oxford, I'll be interacting with them both. Although most of the faces I shall see across the table will be different from those that I met when last working in England. 10 years in Scotland has shown me that other ways of operating are possible, that trust and respect can be a part of teacher education, as well as integrity and honesty. I very much hope to be a small part in researching the new developments in England, where there does seem to be a very real fear that over the next few years, universities will be squeezed out. English politicians and policymakers have been deeply averse to looking at what is happening in other parts of the UK, preferring to look to places like Singapore, Finland, the USA as their points of comparison. I wonder why. So, my first conclusion is that Scotland has much to offer the wider world in relation to teachers, teaching, and teacher education. There's, of course, a danger in complacency, but the future should be seen as developing from what has been achieved here, rather than as replacing something that doesn't work. So great care should be taken, exercised in reforming the Chartered Teacher Scheme, the Teacher Induction Scheme, and indeed the BN. Secondly, care must be taken to develop the relationship between research, policy and practice. This does appear to be under serious threat at present, as I mentioned earlier. I was recently involved in writing a report for the University's Council for the Education of Teachers, UCET, and BERA, on how current policies across the UK may impact on educational research. The picture is not an optimistic one. And here, in spite of Scotland being the only part of the UK which actually increased its research capacity and its research funding through RAE 2008, the report does not envisage a continuation of this success. And even where research is being undertaken, it doesn't always seem to have as much influence on policy as one might hope. So that's the second conclusion. The third conclusion is about the nature of teaching itself as an intellectual profession. It's not just that research on education and teacher education is important. Equally important is research in teaching and teacher education. Teaching does need to be an inquiry-oriented occupation if teachers are really to respond successfully to the needs of the learners and the communities whom they serve. We saw some insights into this in the Schools of Ambition work, and actually there's a very distinctive Scottish tradition in this, drawing from William Boyd of the University of Glasgow, the EIS Education Committee, the SCREE, the Scottish Centre for Research and Education, Scottish Council for Research and Education, and indeed the GTCS more recently with its Teacher Researcher Scheme. all of these bodies had some kind of commitment to a version of teacher as researcher. Of course, the phrase coined by Lawrence Stenhouse. Where did he start out? In Strathclyde. Jordan Hill. So, those are my three conclusions. I'm not finished yet, though. I warn you. The distinctive Scottish contribution to teaching and teacher education, the need for good quality research linking with policy and practice, and the need for teaching itself to be a research-based profession. An adage for you to take home and think about, a version of which I offered to the ISET conference back in July, it goes something like, by their teacher education, ye shall know them. It is my profound belief that you can judge an awful lot about a society and its values by looking at how they organise and provide teacher education. Exciting new times in Scotland, though, in the post-Donaldson era, and Donaldson's still here with us to make sure that it's not actually PD, it's in the presence of Donaldson, as well as looking at the implementation and the challenges that report offers and shows us. Indeed, when I've moved south, I'm very much hoping to keep in touch with these developments, not only at Glasgow, where I'll be continuing for a while to play a role in evaluating the clinical model, but also through a studentship, a Glasgow University School of Education studentship, which is taken by Anna Beck, who's here tonight, who is researching the process of implementation development that arises from the Donaldson report. And I'm glad to say is now a member of the TETWA planning group. I look forward to continuing to play a role, albeit from a distance, and further developing the comparative perspective. Now, in the last, whatever it is, 40 minutes or so that I've been talking, I haven't had time to do justice to all of the wonderful experiences I've had over the past 10 years, or to all the great colleagues I've worked with. But be assured that what I have learned will be put to good use as I re-engage with the peculiarities of the English, to use a phrase coined by the historian E.P. Thompson. Indeed, I hope very much to continue with some of the Four Nations work, for example, through the Teacher Education Group, but also through a group with the happy moniker of CAPER UK, Curriculum Assessment and Pedagogical Reform in the UK, which is where I'll continue working with some of my Glasgow colleagues, including Moira, Louise Hayward, Vivian Bornfield and Kay Livingston. And in the short term, I'll be continuing to work on the clinical model with Jim Conroy, Kevin Loudon from the Scree Centre, Moira Bowman, and others. I really do think there's a lot for us to learn from that clinical model, innovative approach. And we've been discussing it with other providers, including Strathclyde, and look to learn as much as we can from it. And it is interesting, not only in the language of clinical and internship, but it does share some conceptual similarities with the Oxford internship scheme, which was so developed by Donald McIntyre and thrives today, and for which I will have some management responsibility when I move to Oxford. But I think there's real scope for mutual learning. There are elements of the clinical model here in Glasgow which have not been tried in Oxford, and there are elements of the Oxford model that may be of great interest to the clinical model up here. And in particular, I think there's going to be great interest in the redefining of teacher educators' work and what it is to be a teacher educator who happens to be employed by a university, and how you manage the relationships and the role and the function. The next couple of years will prove to be very interesting as you, and I'll no longer say we at that point, as you move towards a referendum on independence.
I must say that from the point of view of teacher education, and indeed more widely from the from teachers' work in education more generally, all the evidence suggests that an independent approach has worked rather well on the whole. A devolved approach, I should say, really. And of course, on that score, in terms of education, in some ways we really have more than 300 years of experience and evidence. But as the referendum approaches, there are one or two other matters around: economics, defence, citizenship, nationality, that may give greater pause for thought. If it was just about education, it might be straightforward. We shall see. I've just been reading this new book by Stefan Collini, What Are Universities For? And as I move towards my end, I just want to, if I may, read you a short extract from his conclusion. Taking a longer-term view of the history and indeed the future of universities encourages us to ask fundamental questions of the goal of contributing to national economic prosperity. That, he argues, has become the dominant goal publicly. For example, how much prosperity do we need, and who counts as we? Is it desirable at any cost? What is it, in its turn, good for? And so on. Any serious attempt to address these questions will inevitably have to invoke non-economic values. Universities are not just good places in which to undertake such fundamental questioning. They also embody an alternative set of values in their very rationale. Attending to these values may help us remember, amid difficult and distracting circumstances, that we are merely custodians for the present generation of a complex intellectual inheritance which we did not create and which is not ours to destroy. And if that's true about universities, and it's certainly something I could agree with in that book, not all of which I would agree with, it's also surely something that's true about teaching and schools themselves and the responsibility they have in social, cultural development. And so my deep commitment to the close engagement between universities and schools in the provision of an education that is worth having is a commitment based on a commitment of broad sense of democratic values and resisting the pressures to prioritise at any cost the economic arguments. George Davy, another one I've been reading recently, The Crisis of the Democratic Intellect, where he came back and looked at the 1920s and the tensions in Scottish higher education about what should be in the course of study at universities. And actually a really interesting tension between a kind of pure philosophical curriculum and a more professionally oriented curriculum that could help to prepare teachers for their actual work. Very interesting. It's the contribution of philosophy in Scottish higher education comes out so clearly from that book, as in the earlier work just called The Democratic Intellect. And it's a particularly Scottish version of the same debate that Collini is picking up, although sadly he doesn't refer to Davy. The universities are very important sites of learning, actually for all professions. In his book, The Long Revolution, Raymond Williams noted the emergence of state education as a continuing struggle between three sets of forces. The old humanists, education for education's sake, the industrial trainers, they're in the dominance at the moment, where it's about economic development, and the public educators who are prioritise the wide literacy, in the full sense of the word, of the population at large for the sake of democracy. Well, those three forces, Williams argued, were in constant struggle during the 19th and 20th century as state education emerged. Actually, we do need all three of those to be present, both in schooling and in universities. But if you let one prevail to the loss of another, it could be very, very damaging. Teachers play such an important part in the social and cultural fabric of society that in these increasingly economistic times, it is no surprise that teachers often feel caught between a rock and a hard place. They're seen sometimes as part of the problem, for example, as when they're reluctant to accept increased performativity, as we found in the teacher working time study, but also they're seen as a crucial part of the solution because of the need to produce citizens with increasingly competitive skills and talents who can contribute to the economic well-being of the country. So there is a real paradox there, a tension for teachers. For me, it is teachers who can help to ensure that today's political priorities do not obscure the wider set of values that is crucial to the long-term well-being of society. Social justice is at least as important as economic prosperity. Long may the democratic intellect, a critical perspective on social and cultural development, continue to have a powerful influence on teaching in Scotland and on Scottish teacher education. Thank you.
Thank you.